Good morning, good evening, good day, everyone. A warm welcome to all the participants that are joining the next part of the Fair Digital Finance Forum by Consumers International. Today, our session bears the title Protecting and Empowering Vulnerable Consumers in the Digital Financial or Finance Marketplace. And I'm very pleased to have a small but excellent panel here in our session today. For everyone who is joining, please use the chat function here in Zoom also to introduce yourself with name and organization affiliation so that everybody knows a little bit who is attending. And also feel free to use that function if you have questions, because after the panelist interventions, we'll of course go over to a question and answers, and you will be encouraged also to ask questions to our panelists. So I see that some people are already using that function. That is fantastic. And I hope everybody was able to join. We're very much on time. I am German. That is more a German feature, actually, to be so much on time. But I hope that everybody can join slowly but surely so that we make the best out of the time that we have. Maybe the dedicated CI team exactly could put up the next slide. Fantastic. So this is today's topic, and I will be delighted to quickly introduce who we are and who you are going to be able to listen to today. So my name is Isabel Busco. I work for the Federation of German Consumer Organizations, which is of course a member of Consumers International. I have a special role in my organization because I'm not based in Berlin with all the other colleagues, but I run a small team in Brussels, Belgium, where all the European Union institutions are hosted. So my job normally is to advocate for better European Union laws for consumers. Next slide, please. And these are our panelists today. So first, we will have the intervention by Matthew Sosorian. And Matthew Sosorian works for the OECD, and he will provide us with an overview drawing on recent research conducted by the OECD. Next will be Martin Grimwood, who works for Ipsos Mori. You may know that this is a research institute. And Martin is a senior client officer with Ipsos Financial Services team in the United Kingdom in Europe. He has over 30 years of market research and consultancy experience, and he will share that experience with us today. And last but not least, my fellow consumer advocate colleague, Ana Echenique from the Spanish, so also European consumer organization, CECU. Ana is the vice president of CECU, which she joined in the year 2000. So you can see there's quite a lot of consumer experience here in the virtual room. And I think with no further delay, we should probably get started.
Fantastic. Yes. Thank you, Isabel. Thank you for that introduction. Again, my name is Matthew Sosorian. I'm calling in from the OECD in Paris, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion. And thank you for inviting us to participate. So just by way of context, the OECD as an organization leads international financial consumer protection policy and coordination. And this is carried out primarily through the G20 OECD Task Force on Financial Consumer Protection, which was established as part of the response to the global financial crisis. And its members represent policymakers from all G20 and OECD countries, as well as international organizations. And the task force is responsible for implementing and maintaining the G20 OECD high-level principles on financial consumer protection. And my colleague, Anna, will be speaking more about these principles at a session tomorrow. They are currently undergoing a review, a 10-year strategic review. And I just want to take a moment to thank Consumers International and your members for participating and providing inputs into this review. So today I'm going to be speaking about some research. You can go back to the, you can, okay, you can keep on that side actually, to be speaking about enhanced protections for consumers who are experiencing vulnerability. So my presentation will start a little bit theoretical and then go into specific examples. So just to say that enhanced protections for consumers who may be vulnerable are an important part of many financial consumer protection regimes around the world. Consumer vulnerability can, however, take different forms, and it can be applicable in different circumstances. And this requires a nuanced understanding and approach to the subject. And the experience of COVID-19 and all of its effects have particularly highlighted the ways in which consumers may experience vulnerability or may be vulnerable, including those who may not have traditionally been considered as such. Okay, you can move on to the next slide. Thank you. So to start with, as I said, for our research, I started by looking at the academic literature on how they've conceptualized consumer vulnerability, because academics from various fields, including psychology, economics, sociology, and marketing, have studied consumer vulnerability, and they've developed different definitions and conceptions of this topic. So broadly speaking, these definitions generally include these three dimensions that you can see on the slide. So on the first bucket is individual characteristics, such as someone's age, their sex, any disabilities they may be living with, their ethnicity, their socioeconomic status. And then we move into individual circumstances, which could be something that someone is experiencing, such as going through a grief or mourning, going through a divorce, losing a job. And then there are external conditions, such as things in the market or in the society where these consumers exist, such as inequality or discrimination or lack of access to services. And so essentially these three dimensions interact to produce situations where consumers may experience vulnerability. You can move to the next slide, please. Thank you. So I just want to note that vulnerability is very much tied to other concepts that we talk a lot about, such as disadvantage and discrimination, and also financial hardship. But I just want to take a second to share some of the thinking that we've done and that we've come across in the literature about how these different concepts are linked, but they are still distinct issues with different implications for policymakers and for firms. So vulnerability is typically thought of as the susceptibility to harm rather than the actual experience of financial harm or financial hardship or detriment. So in other words, vulnerability is the risk of falling into hardship, but it's not necessarily the ongoing situation of living in a certain state of poverty or need. So using this definition, then anyone, regardless of wealth or income, can be vulnerable. And this is a view that it was supported by many jurisdictions and many people's experiences during the COVID-19 pandemic. And then secondly, vulnerability is also, of course, linked to discrimination and disadvantage, but it's not exactly the same thing, and it diverges from these concepts in important ways. So for example, some of the research that we came across explained that disadvantaged groups are disadvantaged because they are unequal, they're worse off than others in a specified context. And vulnerable groups are vulnerable not solely because of a particular characteristic that they share, but because they are subject to harm by marketers or firms. So not everyone who experiences disadvantage might be vulnerable or open to harm, but all vulnerable consumers are by definition open to harm. So following this logic, being quote unquote vulnerable is not something that is permanently attached to consumers who all share a certain characteristic. So in this sense, then the term vulnerable consumer maybe shouldn't be used synonymously or used interchangeably with certain groups such as women, youth, people living on low incomes, ethnic minorities, the elderly, et cetera. So belonging to a certain category doesn't in itself make a vulnerable consumer. Doesn't make a consumer vulnerable. For example, the elderly are not vulnerable simply because they are old, but they are vulnerable when they are susceptible to marketplace harm. Now, at the same time, I do want to emphasize that, of course, certain groups of consumers or certain characteristics make people more likely to experience vulnerability. And this, these characteristics or these circumstances might differ across different jurisdictions or different markets, different countries, but we all are aware of different characteristics or circumstances that can make someone more vulnerable. So in one study, for example, actually from the OECD, looking at the US and looking at consumers in the United States, the authors find that Black and African Americans and Hispanics are more likely to be financially vulnerable than compared to non-Hispanic white Americans. And furthermore, things such as your education level, work status, and net worth also correlate with household financial vulnerability. Next slide, please. So moving on from the sort of academic conceptual world, now moving into the government, what governments and regulatory authorities are doing, they also have developed their own definitions of vulnerability or vulnerable consumers for the purposes of targeting enhanced consumer protections. So the examples here on this slide, these are drawn from different legal or regulatory definitions, and these come from the financial services sector. But it's important to note as well that this concept of vulnerability or vulnerable consumers also arises in many other retail sectors, such as the energy sector, telecommunications, food, or healthcare. And you can see here on this slide that there is a lot of overlap with aligns with the general idea of looking at individual characteristics, looking at individual circumstances, and then how those interact with external circumstances or external factors to produce vulnerability. So the next slide, I will just wrap up, given my time is coming to a close, with some examples from the financial sector of how different governments or regulatory authorities have not only defined vulnerability, but then also implemented guidance or requirements for how firms, banks, financial services providers should address vulnerability and treat vulnerable consumers. And as we know, again, going back to COVID-19, we know that throughout the pandemic, many jurisdictions implemented specific relief programs for consumers who were vulnerable, who were made vulnerable, or who were experiencing financial hardship as a result of the pandemic. So quickly, before I wrap up, I'll just highlight two examples here, just because they kind of capture the idea. So in France, for example, there are regulations that limit the amount of fees that can be charged to quote unquote financially fragile consumers if they do things such as overdraw their account or if there are payment irregularities in their accounts. And then once a consumer is identified as being vulnerable or being fragile, then banks have to offer a specific offer for these clients. And that offer kind of has a basic package of services, it has a monthly fee that's limited, and then there, on top of that, there are capped fees. And then quickly, just in Brazil, similarly, they require supervised entities to account for vulnerable populations. And rather than defining vulnerability by the central bank, these entities are required to develop their own methodologies to analyze customers and then identify them according to different grades of vulnerability. And then once doing that, then they have to make sure that they meet the needs of those customers with appropriate products and services. So I'll finish there. Thank you again for inviting us and really looking forward to the rest of the conversation.
Thank you so much, Matt. Yes, I'm sure there will be further questions addressed to you. You were extremely quick in taking over, so I'll just highlight a few things that I had prepared for my intro, and I think it fits neatly into what you said, because you highlighted a lot also on what has been happening since the pandemic hit. But from a European perspective, we can see that in 2016 already, the European Commission published a study about consumer vulnerability, and I can tell you it's rather a thick board. And in its section on financial services, it reads, and I quote, "The financial services sector is a highly complex environment where many consumers could be seen as vulnerable, including those that would be labeled as sophisticated consumers. In other sectors, in this vein, it's important to highlight that although consumers are a highly heterogeneous group, the vulnerability drivers specific to the financial sector are cross-cutting in that they apply to a very wide range of consumers. However, some consumer groups have nevertheless been identified as being more at risk of becoming vulnerable than others. The feature setting the financial services sector apart from other key sectors examined in this study relates to the high monetary costs and significant potential detriment to well-being that suboptimal financial decisions may cause to individual consumers and also to the economy as a whole. Then they refer a little bit to the 2008 crisis, so that you can see that they draw on slightly different framework at the time. But it's important to keep that in mind if we speak not only about vulnerability as an individual feature, but that it is highlighted that it is more a framework here that needs to be set in the right way. And some parts of the report draw on an analysis from the British member of Consumers International, which who at the time produced a report about consumer vulnerability in financial markets, that certainly highlights also the importance of having consumer groups involved in those regulatory analyses. So although from 2016, this report is an excellent reminder, I think, of the urgency of the challenge to protect vulnerable consumers in the marketplace and the importance of consumer advocacy and collaboration among stakeholders. And that's what we will hear from our two next panelists. So first, I'd like to hear a bit and understand a bit better the current regulatory landscape. And that will be presented by Martin Grimwood from Ipsos Mori, who will deep dive us a little bit into the UK scenario. So you will provide us with a deep dive into the UK case. We will learn about the Financial Conduct Authority's approach to vulnerability and what providers can do individually to ensure there are positive outcomes for consumers. So Martin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Isabel. For those of you who don't know Ipsos, we're a global insight and consultancy firm. We're headquartered in Paris with 89 offices in countries. So that gives us a unique view of financial services across the world. I work in the financial services team in the UK. I'm a senior account director with some of the largest UK banks, as well as the financial services regulator, the FCA. So hopefully that puts me in a unique position to talk about how the regulator is working to protect customers in the UK and how the banks are implementing the guidance they receive from the regulator. Can we go on to the next slide, please? So it's fair to say that protection of vulnerable customers in the UK has evolved over time. So I'm going to take you through on this page a quick overview of how that has evolved and the changes the FCA have made to beef up their protection for consumers. So the FCA regulation is based on six principles. The sixth principle is a starting point for vulnerability regulation that we have today. So that is that a firm must pay due regard to the interests of its customers and treat them fairly. So in 2006, to support this sixth principle, the FCA launched Treating Customers Fairly. And through Treating Customers Fairly, they laid out what they expected from firms in terms of outcomes for their customers if they were to be treated fairly. Now, it's fair to say that Treating Customers Fairly had some impact, but it didn't have the teeth to make that big difference. And some of the issues that Matthew referred to are the backdrop to why that didn't happen. Moving on to 2012, which is arguably one of the biggest shakeups in the UK distribution of financial services, the FCA launched Retail Distribution Review, which really focused on the sale of investment products in three ways. Firstly, they banned the commission-based sales to ensure financial advisors were not influenced by how much commission they could make on a sale. They also required advisors to gain qualifications in order to give advice. And I suppose more importantly, they threatened the banks with big fines for mis-selling. So we started to see in the 2012, really the FCA penalizing banks who were seen not to treat customers fairly. And the game changer really in terms of vulnerability happened just last year. after a long consultation period where the FCA launched vulnerability guidance. So with vulnerability guidance, the FCA set out detailed requirements for firms to protect vulnerable customers with penalties for non-adherence. And I'm going to focus on this over the next few slides. What we've seen, though, even in the last 12 months, is that the FCA have taken vulnerability guidance and created customer care, which creates even more accountability in the UK. And this is still in the consultation stage. Because we're here to talk about Fair Digital Finance, I thought it'd be worthwhile also mentioning a sidecar that took place during this period called the FinTech Sandbox. So the FCA recognized the benefits of FinTechs to the market, arguing that increased competition would lead to better customer outcomes. So they set up a sandbox so that FinTech could play and build and test propositions with regulatory oversight. So arguably the FinTech that are coming to market now have benefited from that so that they have TCF principles built in. If we go on to the next slide, please, we'll just take you through what those FCA vulnerability guidance requirements are. So there are four requirements. The first one is to understand the needs of vulnerable customers. So firms have to identify the drivers of vulnerability for their sector. And this requirement applies to all financial services firms, whether they're banks, insurers, investment companies, effectively if they're regulated by the FCA. So the differences across the sector need to be taken into account. Once firms have identified vulnerable customers, they need to understand the impact of their products and services on those vulnerable customers and anticipate the outcomes of any interaction those vulnerable customers have with them. Once they've done that, they need to make sure that there is a cultural change within the firm, that training and empowerment takes place so that vulnerable customers' needs are met, both in terms of the product development, but also the front line staff who interact with customers on a regular basis. Which leads us to the third practical action, which is that they need to respond to vulnerable customers through everything they do: product design, customer service, and communications. So a good example of this is during the pandemic, how banks were able to flex, especially on loan products, to allow some vulnerable customers, probably those individuals who'd been furloughed during the pandemic, to take repayment holidays on loans. That's the kind of initiative that the FCA are looking to the banks to put into place. The firms then need to constantly monitor and develop to ensure that the outcomes of vulnerable customers are similar to the outcomes of non-vulnerable. But I suppose the million-dollar question that the banks ask and other financial services providers in the UK is, well, what constitutes vulnerability? What's the definition? How can we identify them? So if we go on to the next slide, please. I'll put a very familiar picture up of Where's Wally? And I suppose as banks who started to look at the guidance from the FCA felt just like this. There are so many frameworks of vulnerability. If you just Google vulnerability frameworks, hundreds will appear. So the FCA were very specific in terms of identifying what vulnerability means to them in financial services. Now, there is a challenge here for financial services providers because they were doing a lot already to protect vulnerable customers before financial guidance was launched by the FCA. And that's partly because of legislation, such as provision for customers with disabilities, and also simply because it's the right thing to do. So purposeful banks were already focusing on these issues. However, what we saw from the FCA was that their definition of vulnerability, and it's something that echoes through Matt's earlier presentation, is a lot wider than the banks had anticipated. So they defined vulnerability very carefully to avoid ambiguity, to create consistency, and to create conformity across the industry. So if we go to the next slide, please, I'll just take you through what that looks like in terms of defining vulnerable customers based on FCA guidance in the UK at the moment. So FCA vulnerability is based on four key drivers shown on the right-hand side. Firstly, we have health, which covers illness, which impacts on a customer's ability to carry out day-to-day tasks. So that's including things like sight and hearing impairments, but also mental health issues. We also have low financial capability, which covers low knowledge of financial matters or confidence in managing money. We also have negative life events. So these are major life events, such as bereavement or breakdown of relationships or redundancies. And the largest group is low financial resilience. And this is the ability to withstand emotional or financial shocks. What you'll notice from the sum of all the drivers on the right-hand side is that they're greater than the overall vulnerability figure we show here. And this is because of the intersectionality of vulnerability. So for example, you may have low financial resilience because you have experienced a negative life event. And that's something that Matthew mentioned earlier in terms of the work that he'd done across other frameworks. But one of the key things about the drivers is that they some can be determined in advance. For example, low financial capability or disability. So the bank could arguably identify low financial capability through the data they hold on a customer, whilst others might happen in the future, such as a negative life event. And again, that's something that Matthew picked up on in his earlier presentation. So what the FCA are requiring firms to do is to anticipate both. Now, if you look at the stats on the slide, these are generated from research that the Ipsos does for our clients in the UK. And what we've done is replicated the research that the FCA have done through Financial Lives to get to those numbers. So digital inclusion here isn't actually included in the definition, but what we know through the analysis that we've done is that vulnerable customers are more than twice as likely to be digitally excluded than non-vulnerable, which is something that needs to be taken into account when we talk about digital finance. What I'm going to do is just close on a few stats to focus on digital exclusion to give you an idea of how prevalent that is in the world and in the UK. So next slide, please. Looking at data generated prior to the pandemic, it's clear that that 37% of the world's population is not using the internet. So in effect, they're digitally excluded. If you go on to the next slide, please. In the UK, which arguably is an advanced country in terms of access to mobile and PC-based internet, around a fifth of the UK population claim not to have the necessary digital skills to set up simple bank accounts online. And that becomes a problem when offline brands suddenly shift to online-only distribution channels. So on the right-hand side, we can see here a manifestation of that taken from last week's Guardian, one of the broadsheet newspapers in the UK, where we can see a letter to the Guardian's financial agony aunt, where a customer who was previously comfortable with online banking has now been forced to move to an app-based solution, which they cannot access. So for the offline traditional banking organizations, it does pose a huge problem as they move towards online distribution of services. It also provides a significant problem for the regulator where they're trying to apply a one-size-fits-all regulation for digital finance. So can you allow digital only brands that are launching just to offer digital and then decline that to the traditional banks? Or on my final slide, I wanted to leave with a positive point here, that digital can be an inclusivity game changer. And this is data that I've stolen with pride from one of my colleagues in Latin America, whereby she's been looking at the Financial Inclusion Index for Latin America, where we can see that there's a significant proportion of Latin America which is unbanked with very low financial inclusion stats. And what we've seen there is that the growth of digital-only brands, which are actually opening up for the first time or democratizing payment systems for the unbanked, such as Mercado Pago, NewQ and New. So I'll hand over to you, Isabel. Again, sorry for overrunning. Hopefully that's given you an idea of the landscape for regulation in the UK, but also a little deeper insight into the challenges for digital inclusion.
Thank you very much, Martin. It has indeed, and I'm grateful for your last slide to have included also a little perspective from another part of the world, because we're a bit developed economy centric, if I may say, on our panel. So I would like to already encourage colleagues and participants here that follow us to prepare their questions that they can ask to the panelists in a moment. Once we have listened to our final panelist, who is Ana Echenique from the Spanish consumer organization, CECU. And I think, Ana, the closing words of Martin are actually a good starting point for you also, because we've been discussing a lot vulnerability in financial markets generally speaking now, and vulnerability generally speaking, but this specific angle of financial services and financial markets moving to the digital world and to digital only is of course a specific challenge, and I'm very curious to hear what you have to report from your experience in Spain, and then later on, maybe some colleagues also from other places in the world. Ana, the floor is yours. Ana, wait, your microphone is muted. We cannot hear you yet.
Excuse me.
Perfect.
Yes, well, thanks a lot for inviting me here, because in these meetings, the most important part is learning. And to listen to Matthew and to Martin has been very important. So now I'm going to start with a sentence, with a statement that Carlos San Juan de la Orden, an 80-year-old retired surgeon, said in a newspaper, and it was, "I am an old man, but I'm not an idiot." So this statement came in the exact moment, because everyone, it's a critical point of discontent, and even we can say anger, with the banks and the financial services. I think that not only elderly people, but everyone is left out. It's uncomfortable, it's very different from what it was a short time ago. And now digital accessibility should have been friendly and should have been thought, should have been designed thinking on the needs of people. But I don't know what happens, that it comes, it's always up down. Someone designs something and we have to accept it instead of starting down up to see exactly what we need. And interfaces, applications, and programs are not friendly. And you can realize it anytime you go out of your ambit, your day-to-day work. When you go out of that, it's not friendly, really. It's not easy. And this happens, I think we can extrapolate elderly to whatever vulnerable risk or situation that have been described before. It's a pity, because this last generation technology has resulted more an obstacle than a bridge to solve problems. Now we are in touch with the University of Granada, and Professor Francisco Liebana Cabanillas is starting a research on financial exclusion of the elderly. And there he is doing a very deep statistica, how do you say, questions to big, importantly, statistical groups of what is happening to the elderly within their accessibility to digital finances, and especially finances, because that is the worst part of it. We call it marketplace here in our title, and really most of the population, elderly population, really just wants to put their money in, take it out, and see how their bills are being paid. So it's not even a marketplace for most of the people. And then they won't use other services that are getting more and more sophisticated instead of taking care of the ones that are. there's a lack of competition. There used to be institutions like saving banks that were public in a way, and they guaranteed to attend the people, but they were taken away some years ago. Now all bank is private, so you can't choose because they're all doing the same type of activity. So that's another thing we need, a public bank that would really take care of the citizens and would be moved by different motivations. Then we are also kept away from using cash. And when we know that plastic money, that credit cards or debit cards really are expensive to keep, and they also threaten our privacy, and it adds expenses. I think that this has been especially hard on rural population, where that is being now absolutely impossible. So one of the points that we see that we have lost is the CSR in the financial system and bank system. In 2004, we founded the CSR Observatory with other 15 organizations, and it was fantastic how they all went into the global compact spirit, and there we talked about the accountability, and there was a communication between consumers and all the actors, let's say, around any type of company. Well, that has gone away after the crisis in the 2007 and 2008. CSR disappeared, and there's no accountability and no social view, and not even an environmental view isn't as strong as it was then. They didn't have to tell us what to do. We don't have, consumers organizations don't have enough strength. The asymmetry between our resources and the ones of the firms or banks or whatever is enormous. I mean, we can't really reach the people. We can't really find out what is really going on. So, and there's another thing, that political parties are financed by the banks, so they are not really, really hard on them. There's at least there's a suspicion in the in this. But our strength is in information, and to reach the people and to have everyone informed is complicated. What we do in TheKu is network. We sit with all type of organizations. We sit with trade unions, with parliamentary groups, with other organizations, with politicians and with firms. And that's how we do our lobby work. And it's looking at the people's face. At the end, we're talking about another world, absolutely different of the digital world. In this presential or physical world, when we look at the other person's eyes, we can agree. And we can get to points where we find out, we see that behind someone who is representing an institution, a financial institution, there's a person that really understands that it's different to be an elderly person if you're alone or if you have a grandson or a granddaughter. That makes the difference now. And so we know, we think that we all have to learn to reach agreements, looking for the common grounds, what we have in common. They need us. We are their clients, whatever age or activity we have. And so in this win-win concept that was that is so talked about in the companies and firms and so ever, win-win has to include consumers. We have to act as if we were doctors. We have to listen to consumers. We have to hear about their symptoms. We have to analyze what's going on, and then we have to diagnose what is going wrong. And then with all this networking and with all these groups that want to do things better, we have to start constructing a different world, because what's really important is that no one can be left behind. We are now in 2022, and I think that's the real message. No one can be left behind.
Thank you very much, Anna. This is a great appeal also, your last words. So please join me in thanking all the panelists for their opening interventions. And we would like to pick up a few aspects and discuss them a bit further. And I have seen that there are already questions in the FAQ section of our Zoom system. So maybe Consumers International colleagues, it would be nice if you could try to unmute the first colleague so that he can ask the question directly and live. It's a bit nicer maybe than if I ask it, if I read it out. And so the first comes from Michael Mungoma, I think. It's from Kenya. And if that is possible to hear Michael, that would be great so that Michael can ask his questions directly. And maybe you could specify who of the three panelists you would like to address your question. And to my panelists, please keep it as concise as possible. Do we have Michael? Can we hear Michael? Okay, maybe if that is not the case, I see that there may be a technical glitch. That is not a huge problem. Then Michael, sorry, but you typed it in. I will read it out for you then. So Michael is asking, how can civil societies, especially in middle and low-income countries, effectively ensure that governments provide safety among consumers? And maybe I'd ask some of the speakers here on the panel that have some insights drawn from different countries. Maybe Matt, do you have any clues for Michael?
Sure, yeah, I'm happy to share a bit. So some of the very effective ways that civil societies can help to provide insights to regulators or to governments are through things such as consumer panels that provide input at regular times or in response to particular legislative or regulatory proposals that an authority might be considering. And I know that those are not always in place in every country, but that's one opportunity to ensure that this input is institutionalized, so to speak, so that it's not just a one-off response. But I'll stop there. So I see Anna has
Well, I'd like to tell Michael that we don't have to invent anything. Just take a look all over the world. We have Consumers International as a place to look for, to see what has been done in other places, and maybe start with some example that has worked.
Thank you both for that contribution. And I think there is another question that I see here in the chat, not in the question and answer section, that relates a little bit to that same question. I read here, what barriers do you see to the development of policies that protect vulnerable consumers in digital finance? And maybe, Anna, I would ask you to give a few hints from your work. What kind of barriers there are to actually develop those policies? You've already mentioned a few, the conflict of interest that there may be with banks or other financial institutions, but maybe you can name one or two others.
Well, in any case, I think we have to use properly democracy. We have to insist in getting in touch with our politicians, with our representatives. When there are elections, we have to sit with them quite a time before elections come, telling them what is going on. We have to ask our fellow consumers, friends, different ages, different ambits, and tell them this is going on. We have to go with data and with information and look at them at the eyes. I insist a lot in personal communication. And I think use democracy, that's the best tool we have.
Thank you, Anna. I have another question. I'll try to take as many as we can, because that's the purpose also to exchange here on this session. There's a question by Felicia Monnier, if I'm not completely mistaken, from Nigeria. And she writes, given the different aspects of vulnerability identified in today's papers, are there common grounds or principles that can be adopted by financial institutions to help the affected consumers? I think that reads like a question to you, Martin. So have you identified in your work common grounds or common principles that could be adopted across the board, also maybe globally?
Yeah, I think two things come to mind. The first is about inclusion. So one of the questions that we were discussing prior to this event was, you know, how many of us are vulnerable or potentially vulnerable? And I think the answer to that is, well, we all are. So the first principle is that vulnerability shouldn't be about what is measurable now, but what could happen in the future. So firms should be able to anticipate their customers' needs going forward. And that echoes what Anna was saying about understanding customers' needs and building solutions, products, services, distribution channels that meet those needs. So I think it's anticipating what could happen is really important. And that seems to echo in Matt's research and the basis of the FCA. I think the other principle as well is that it needs to be enforced, because what we've seen through the history of the regulator in the UK, through trial and error, they've found that, say, treating customers fairly, which I mentioned earlier, which started in 2006, that was not quite self-regulation, but it was an ask to the industry to regulate themselves properly. And what we found was that, well, that didn't quite happen. Boards of big banks have shareholders. There are other things to focus on. So I think any framework to protect customers, not just vulnerable customers, but any customer, needs to have a strong regulator with teeth. So they're my two main principles, I think.
Before I take Anna, and I saw your hand, I'll give you the floor in a second. I would like to take, it's more a demand, I think, than a real question that we have here, but I think it's really important. It comes from Indonesia. Let me read it out to you. So first, it's great insights in this session. So the question comes from Nukolis Nukolis. I hope I pronounced this halfway right. Apologies if not. I want to know if there are any written material and articles, for example, from those speakers, because I want to read more explanation. In my experience in Indonesia, the governing body always talks about literacy, but not much on this kind of vulnerability. They don't give enough attention to the consumer, instead accusing the consumer of lack of literacy. And this is more a question to the panelists. Maybe we could put together, you could pull from your experience, from your research, a few key studies, also that those that you have produced yourself, maybe we could send them around at the end of the session as a follow-up after this week, so that the participants also have a little bit of material that they can point their own governments towards or their own policymakers. I think that would be a great outcome here if we could pull something a little bit together. Anna, I have not forgotten about you. The floor is yours.
No, that about common grounds and principles, I think that there's an important point. That's the language we use and how we try to reach the people. Each group is very different, and this is very important to have a simple language and make things that are really accessible and understandable.
Excellent. Thank you, Anna. I see another question, I think, that is very important here in the context of what we're discussing. For me, it is displayed by an anonymous participant, and it reads, is the concept of vulnerability similar across digital and offline contexts, or are there any nuanced differences? So I think, Matt, Martin, that calls maybe on your expertise first.
I can only share with you what I know through how the FCA look at this, and I think from conversations with colleagues around the world, I think the FCA are at the forefront of really kind of defining the framework. I would say that from what I've heard from the FCA, their guidance is channel agnostic. So regardless of which channel, the same considerations need to be taken into account. But I think it would be naive to think that, say, a digital-only brand that had just launched should have the availability for non-digital customers. And I think that's the challenge, as I said at the end of my presentation. It's something that we're starting to see come through now, because we're seeing, as Anna was pointing out, the traditional banks starting to close branches, and they're replacing them with digital solutions. That's a conundrum, and it's something that the regulator has to tackle. How you can keep the human in a traditional banking relationship that probably you've had for 30, 40, 50 years in some cases, and all of a sudden the access to a human is turned off. That is a huge challenge. But generally, the principles of vulnerability apply across all channels.
Thank you, Martin. Matt, do you have something to add, please?
Jump in on that. I agree with everything that Martin said. And I think that, again, it comes down to sort of these different interactions of personal characteristics and, in this case, delivery channel characteristics or product characteristics. So going back to what Anna was speaking about when she was mentioning elderly populations, for example. So in an analog context, older customers might be considered at risk of vulnerability for a variety of reasons, challenges about making decisions on their own, for example. But then in a digital context, then those interactions become perhaps stronger, and there are additional vulnerabilities that arise because of a lack of familiarity with digital technology, or because of a lack of access lack of familiarity. So I think that then the principles should be the same, but then in terms of what are the policy responses and how do we actually address those vulnerabilities, I think that then it becomes more nuanced, as the person asked.
Thank you. Yes, so it's mutually reinforcing in a way. I think we would have time for one more question, but I also see, I think, a great comment in the chat that is coming from South Korea. Don't know if you've all seen it, but it reads, policymakers and authorities in Korea tend to focus on the elderly, poor and young when discussing financial vulnerability and shape most policies for those consumers. However, Korean consumer advocacy groups are arguing that anyone can be vulnerable. And that's a little bit also what the European Commission already said in 2016. So the colleague highlights, I like the OECD and FCA's nuanced framework where vulnerability is defined as a more fluid or dynamic. So I think that calls again for sharing some of the resources so that it can be used in other parts of the world. And there are also resources being shared about Canada, just to highlight that. Sorry, Matt, please.
No, I'm sorry for interrupting. I was just going to say that I appreciate this comment. And I think that one of the ways that obviously vulnerability is getting a lot of attention right now, and there's a lot of discussion about it. And I think that's fantastic. And I think that one of the potential effects of this will be that the more we recognize that we are all potentially vulnerable, then it kind of ultimately underscores the importance of a strong financial consumer protection framework itself for everyone. So yes, on the one hand, of course, there are certain characteristics or certain populations that might be at risk, and there needs to be a framework that's developed to address those particular risks and the ways that those interactions happen to produce vulnerability. But at the same time, recognizing, for example, through COVID, that anyone can become vulnerable, ultimately what that means is that governments, regulators, legislators may need to ensure that there is a robust financial consumer protection framework that is in place and that is enforced, as my other panelists had mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, thank you, Matt. That is also from a consumer advocacy point of view, really worth highlighting. Anna, I see your hand up.
Well, I think that if something is accessible, it's logic, it's friendly, it's accessible, logic, and friendly for everyone. It doesn't mean that the bright ones are left out. I mean, once I said in a building, this building isn't accessible. And the architect said, yes, there's a door there on the side. And I said, no, something is accessible when everyone goes in through the same door. And that's what we're asking for. There's one door and anyone can get in through that unique door. It has to be normal. I think it's a problem of the people who design programs, applications, interfaces, etc. I mean, they don't look for our needs and they don't think on what all the processes we have to go through.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you to everyone, particularly Matt and Martin, to the three panelists for all your very valuable contributions. I think there are a few key takeaways from, of course, our perspective as an organization, if I may. We have really come to the conclusion, just like Anna said, it's important that the framework is right. If you just put the burden on the individual consumer, and at the same time, putting also the burden at the financial institutions to check the potential vulnerability of every individual consumer, you'll never get there. It's a lot of burden, but instead try to apply what Anna was saying, create a framework that works for everyone. In our experience here in Europe, that's been a really tough one. Even after the financial crisis, we've not been able to really push it through. So I wish all the colleagues that work on advocacy in their regions good luck for them. But what is encouraging is that defining vulnerability is actually a challenge that policymakers and regulators are dealing with globally and picking up more in some regions than in others, but we can all learn from each other. And maybe we should not focus on the definition only. What is probably also useful, and we've learned that today, is that some successful approaches exist already to track vulnerability, and it's being rolled out in different areas. And industry needs to measure the consumer outcomes. I think that is something that as consumer groups, we can then also use to show progress or lack of progress. So here, consumer advocacy plays an important role in protecting those who are vulnerable and to help inform policymakers and industry, both of them. That is my takeaway from today. I hope everyone had their own takeaways. We will follow up with a few resources shared by our experts. If you want to know more, of course, not only about Consumer International's work, but also the members' work, upcoming events, and so on and so forth, here are the ways how you can do it. Follow